Okay, everyone. Welcome back to Lex Will Hug. Have you ever had one of those moments like you hit send on an email or drop something important in the mailbox and instantly like second guess yourself?
Oh, totally. I think
Yeah.
we've all been there, right? Especially when it's something something legal or with a tight deadline, like a
Yeah,
contract.
exactly. Like a contract, like right
Yeah.
before a big deadline,
You're
like.
like, wait, should I have done that?
Yeah, and for law students especially, contracts are like a huge part of just the whole field. So today we're diving into a case that really gets at the heart of that what have I done feeling when it comes to contract law.
That's right. And the case we're unpacking today is Soldow v. Organon, Inc. It really boils down to a super fundamental question in contract law. When exactly, like at what precise moment, is a legal agreement actually formed? And it might seem straightforward at first, but as we'll see, it can get pretty tricky.
Yeah, it sounds like there are some twists and turns in this one. So to help us make sense of it all, we've got a super detailed case brief, a standard legal analysis breaking down all the legal jargon, and some expert commentary too. And as always, we're here to distill all the key takeaways and make them clear and relevant for you, our awesome law student listeners.
We're breaking it down for you.
So let's jump right in. Can you set the stage for us? What's the story behind this Soldow case?
Okay, so we start with John Soldow. He was let go from his job at Organon, a pharmaceutical company. And as part of his exit, standard procedure, Organon offered him a severance package. But there was a little incentive built in. They offered to double his severance pay if he signed a release waiving any legal claims he might have against them, related to his termination.
Okay, so pretty typical severance negotiation so far,
Yeah.
right? I mean, a company wants to protect itself from potential lawsuits and the employee gets a better payout. What's the catch?
Well, this is where things take a bit of an unexpected turn. Soldow agreed to the terms. She signed the release, dated it, and dropped it in the mailbox, outside the post office. But then get this. He gets back home, and he discovers that Organon had already sent him the severance check, like the enhanced severance check.
Oh, I see where this is going. So he mails the release, then realizes the check is already on its way, and that's when the second thoughts hit, right?
Exactly. He has a sudden change of heart. And so he does something pretty unusual. He actually goes back to the post office and somehow, manages to convince a postal worker to fish his signed release out of the mailbox.
No way. He actually got it back. That's impressive, if not a little unorthodox, right?
Right. It's not something you hear every day. But retrieving the release wasn't the end of the story. Soldow then cashes the enhanced severance check that Organon had sent him. And after all that, he decides to go ahead and file a lawsuit against Organon, alleging age discrimination under the ADEA.
The Age Discrimination and Employment Act, right?
Right, the ADEA.
Yeah.
So even though he retrieved the release, he went ahead with the lawsuit.
Okay, so this is where the legal plot thickens. He tries to undo his acceptance by taking the release back, but then he cashes the check and then sues. That creates a huge legal question, right? Did that initial act of mailing the release, even though he got it back, legally bind him to the agreement?
Exactly. The core issue the court had to grapple with was whether a contract was formed the second that signed release went into the mailbox, or if getting it back before Organon saw it effectively nullified the acceptance. And this leads us straight into a super important legal concept, the mailbox rule.
Okay, so let's break down this mailbox rule. What exactly is it and how does it apply here?
So the mailbox rule basically says that when you're accepting an offer, especially through the mail, your acceptance becomes legally effective the moment you send it off, like when you drop that letter in the mailbox. It doesn't matter when the person who made the offer actually receives it. The key is when you relinquish control and put it into the postal system.
So it's all about that moment of sending, not receiving. So applying that to Soldow, you're saying that the second that signed release was in the mailbox, legally speaking, he'd accepted Organon's offer, regardless of retrieving it later.
Right. That was ultimately what the court decided in this case. And here's an important detail. Organon's offer didn't specifically say how Soldow had to accept. And when that happens, when an offer doesn't specify the method of acceptance, the default rule, especially for things sent by mail, is this mailbox rule.
This mailbox rule, it's not just some recent legal trend, right? Where does this rule come from?
Yeah, it's definitely not new. In the Soldow decision, the court actually cited several major legal authorities to support this. One source was pre-Erie federal common law. Now, pre-Erie refers to the body of law that federal courts developed before a landmark Supreme Court case, Erie Railroad Cumbie Tompkins. That case really shifted things.
Right. I remember Erie. It basically said federal courts should apply state law in certain cases, right?
Exactly. But the mailbox rule is kind of unique. It was already established in federal common law before Erie came along. So federal courts have continued to use this mailbox rule for cases involving contract formation by mail, even in situations where they might typically apply state law.
So even though Erie generally pushes for using state law, the mailbox rule is like a holdover from before that shift.
Yeah, you got it. It's a specific exception to the general rule of Erie. So in Soldow's case, it was federal common law, not state law, that determined when that contract was formed. And the court also cited the restatement, second, of contracts, specifically Section 63, that formally lays out this dispatch rule for acceptance. And they also pointed to a bunch of respected contract law textbooks that back up this principle.
So multiple sources, all pointing to this mailbox rule as a well-established concept.
Yeah, it's a pretty fundamental rule.
Okay. Now, back to Soldow. The mailbox rule says acceptance is valid upon mailing, but he physically got that release back before Organon even saw it. Why didn't that change anything legally? Why wasn't that considered retracting his acceptance?
Well, here's how the court looked at it. Legally speaking, the contract is formed the instant you send that acceptance off. It's done. So even though Soldow got the release back, the court said that doesn't magically rewind time and undo the formation of the contract. Once he put that signed release in the mailbox and it was in the hands of the Postal Service, he'd legally accepted Organon's offer. Retrieving it didn't erase that action.
I can see how that might seem a bit unfair or counterintuitive, especially if Organon never actually saw the release. So what's the rationale behind sticking so strictly to the mailbox rule? Why is it so important to pinpoint the moment of mailing as the defining moment of acceptance?
That's a great question. The court really stressed the need for certainty in commercial deals. Like, imagine the chaos if people could accept an offer through the mail and then just snatch it back before it arrived. It would make contracts super unreliable. No one would know what was actually agreed upon. The mailbox rule prevents that by providing a clear-cut point in time, the moment of dispatch. Once you've properly mailed your acceptance, you should be able to rely on that action. It also protects you if your acceptance is delayed or even lost in the mail, things that are out of your control once you've dropped it in the box.
So it's about creating a firm, verifiable moment where both sides can know for sure if there's a deal or not.
Exactly. It helps avoid all sorts of potential disputes and uncertainty. Plus, it also helps determine who bears the risk if something goes wrong in the process.
Mm-hmm.
Once you, as the offeree, mail that acceptance, any problems with the mail itself, delays, loss, whatever, are generally considered the offeror's problem. The risk shifts once you've done your part correctly.
Right, so both sides know where they stand. Now, was there any argument presented that maybe acceptance shouldn't be effective until the offeror actually receives it? Because that seems like a more intuitive approach in some ways.
Yeah, there's this less common view in contract law called the receipt rule that says acceptance is only valid when the offeror gets it. The Soldow court actually acknowledged that a previous court had followed this receipt rule, but they basically dismissed it as an outlier.
They weren't convinced.
Not at all.
Yeah.
They really emphasized how almost everyone else does things. We're talking 49 states and the restatement of contracts all use the mailbox rule. That kind of consistency is super important, especially when you have contracts crossing state lines.
Yeah. Consistency helps simplify things.
Totally. Plus, focusing on the mailing keeps it objective. You can prove when something was mailed. Soldow tried to argue that his intent mattered, that since he retrieved the letter, he didn't really mean to accept, but the court said no. The act of mailing is what counts legally.
So intent versus action, and the court sided with the concrete action of mailing. Okay, so the court said the contract was formed when Soldow mailed the release, and him getting it back didn't change that. What did this mean for his age discrimination lawsuit against Organon?
Well, because that release was considered a valid binding contract, Soldow had basically waived his right to sue Organon for anything related to his firing. That included his age discrimination claim under the ADEA, so his lawsuit was ultimately dismissed.
It backfired.
It did. And remember how he cashed the severance check after getting the release back? That definitely didn't help his case.
Yeah, that seems like it would further reinforce the idea that he accepted the deal, even if he later had second thoughts.
Right. The contract was already formed, legally speaking, when he mailed the release. But cashing the check after retrieving it, that just strengthens the argument that he was on board with the agreement, even if he tried to backpedal.
So for all our law student listeners out there, let's bring it all home. Yeah. What are the big takeaways from this Soldow case and this whole mailbox rule concept?
Okay, key points to remember. First, that mailbox rule. It's the standard, unless an offer explicitly says otherwise. Acceptance by mail is generally valid when you send it, not when it's received. That's something you absolutely need to know for your exams and for when you're out there practicing law.
Contracts are everywhere.
Everywhere. It's also super important to understand who bears the risk if something goes wrong with the mail. Once that acceptance is out of your hands, it's generally on the offeror to deal with any issues.
So choose your mailing method wisely.
For sure. And this case also shows how older legal concepts, like this pre-Erie federal common law, can still have an impact today. It adds another layer to how you understand the legal system as a whole.
It's like a little legal history lesson mixed in.
Exactly. And it's kind of fascinating how this very physical act of putting something in the mail still has so much weight in our digital world. It really makes you wonder how courts will handle these principles with email, texts, and all these other ways we communicate now.
Yeah, that's a good point. As technology changes, so does the law.
Exactly. It's constantly evolving.
Okay, so to sum it all up, Soldow v. Organon really drives home this idea of the mailbox rule and how it can have some pretty big consequences. Once that acceptance hits the MIF box, you're likely bound by that agreement, even if you have second thoughts. Future lawyers, take note.
Absolutely. And to your point about technology, I think it really raises some thought-provoking questions. Like, as we move further into this digital world where communication is often instant, how will the courts adapt these old-school mailbox rule principles to things like email, texts, even social media? It's a really interesting area of law that's still being figured out.
Yeah, definitely something for us all to keep an eye on. As always, the legal landscape never stands still. Well, a huge thank you to everyone for joining us for this deep dive into Soldow v. Organon. We hope you found it insightful. And until next time, keep those legal minds sharp and keep exploring those fascinating legal issues.